Tonight we welcome to the show author Ed Rose to discuss his new book, Raised by the Church. Stay tuned for Bob. Welcome, everyone, to How's New York. I am your host again, Robert Howe, and we are talking about a multitude of topics, including real estate, community, politics, and any hot topic of the day. We are broadcasting from an undisclosed location in Brooklyn, New York, to a potential audience stretching from Longyearbyen, Norway, to Ushuaia, Tierra del Fuego, thanks to the power of Blog Talk Radio. I'm here with my executive producer, Jason Versace, of Rising Tide Marketing. We have as our guest tonight Ed Rose. Ed Rose is a critically acclaimed author of a recent book about himself, an autobiography, Raised by the Church, a story of Ed growing up in New York City's Catholic orphanages. Welcome to the show, Ed.
Thank you, Robert. I really appreciate this opportunity. And, well, on behalf of my co-author, Judith Esprin, thank you very much.
Well, we're welcome to have you. I mean, we're having you on basically because this is a courageous story that you're telling, Ed. You are relaying a story of your youth back in the 40s and 50s, and it's painful, it's bittersweet, there's a little comedy involved there. But, you know, there is that overall tragic and sad trend to the book, and it must have taken a lot of courage for you to sit down and say, I feel the need to share this with, you know, the rest of the world. What made you come to that conclusion?
I'm glad you brought that question. That's an excellent question, Robert. Excellent, because what happened about 10 years ago, I was reflecting back on my life. And I realized for the first 10 years of my adult life, I worked with abandoned, abused, and neglected children and families. And then the next 17 years, I had the opportunity, because of Coach Tom Pender, a former of Ford University, I worked with student athletes, people from the socioeconomic class that I felt had the rites of passage. And then for the following 17 years until the present day, I had the opportunity to work with middle-class, working-class families with their children running team basketball up in Pennsylvania. And one day I said to myself, wait a minute, I'm working with three different target populations in my career, in my life, and all three have one common denominator. All three have obstacles to overcome. All socioeconomic classes have something to overcome. And I said, you know what? If Ed Rose can do it, I think my story would help all three target populations. And that's how it came about, Robert. That's how it came about.
Ed, I tell you, you know, they refer to books as page turners, and you usually think of them as some sort of a spy thriller. But, you know, your book was a page turner because, you know, it spoke about a lot of painful topics and topics that maybe our society doesn't want to think about or know about. But you brought it to the forefront, and really, it was quite a revelation. I loved reading your book. You and Judith have done a wonderful job telling this story. Ed, the orphanage system back in the 40s and 50s is not what we know today. Maybe you could contrast a little the type of child care that the city provided, the city or the church or the social service agencies provided back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and against the type of protective services that are being offered today.
I'm glad you brought that up because in those days there was very little government subsidies or no government subsidies. The Catholic orphanages, the Sisters of Mercy and the Marianist Brothers and the priests did it really because of the grace of God and charitable contributions to the agencies. And in those days when I was born into my first orphanage at 6 months of age, my mother and father had me out of wedlock. They wanted an abortion. They couldn't afford an abortion. So consequently, they had me out of wedlock. They gave me to a maternal aunt for 6 months in a rooming house in Brooklyn, who the landlord did not allow children, so she was petrified. So the mother came back 6 months later, and there's more details in the book, of course, but she brought me to my first Catholic orphanage, Angel Guardian Home in the Bensonhurst, and dropped me off and never relinquished their parental legal responsibilities, and therefore, because of not signing the parental papers, I had to be transferred from place to place in five Catholic orphanages. And in each one of those places, we had, on average, in the dormitories, between 24 and 72 boys in one room. There wasn't bedrooms, there wasn't living rooms, there was no small kitchens, it was institutions. The best analogy I can give you, Robert, is the shelter system today, in today's society, where they have maybe 100 or 75 to 100 men, women living in one room, with just beds lined up with a bed and a locker. And that's how I lived for 19 years, going from place to place to place. But at the same time, I think they did a remarkable job, Robert. I really, reflecting back on, with the limited resources and the number of thousands and thousands of babies and children coming into care, they were overwhelmed by the respect, and by the, they were overwhelmed, just overwhelmed by the numbers of people coming in like myself. And so I went from place to place. And then I went from Angel Guardian Home to Covenant of Mercy in Fort Greene, and in the St. Mary's of the Angels Home in Syosset. And for those three institutions, I had the Sisters of Mercy. And then when I reached about 11 years of age, I was transferred to St. John's Home in Rockaway Beach, New York, that was run by the Marinus Brothers. And in that setting, we had 140 boys in that setting, and we had 38 boys in each dormitory, with one religious brother. And it's the same with the nuns. One person taking care of up to 32 children, 72 children, you name it. And it was remarkable how they had the control and discipline. And everything was institutionalized. So everything was structured. We had our play clothes, we had our school clothes, and we had our clothes to go out. And that's basically what happened. And then, Robert, one great story was that in the way I met two people, Angel Guardian, what I call them angels, were Sister Johanna and Catherine McCarthy. And I bring that up because if it wasn't for Aunt Catherine, who I called my Aunt Catherine, she was really Sister Johanna's biological sister, who met me at 4 years of age, if I didn't take her by the skirt and say, "Who are you?" when she was visiting her sister, because in those days the nuns were not allowed out of the convent. So she was visiting, I said, "My name is Eddie Rose, what's your name?" As a result of that one contact, for 19 years, Robert, that was my only contact with the outside world. My only contact with the outside world for those 19 years was this woman called Aunt Catherine, or Catherine McCarthy. And I realize now today that if it wasn't for that, I was institutionalized, Robert. There's no question about it, I was institutionalized. In fact, in the book, it tells the story how they sent me to a voluntary family in Long Island. And for a week or two, I felt more safer in that institution than with that loving family in Long Island, in Hicksville, Long Island. And so I knew by that time, by 11 years old, I was institutionalized. And I was petrified of the outside world, Robert. And the school, the education was done all on the grounds of the institutions. And I think that I had a remarkable education. Of course, because of some experience of being fearful of being moved on, at the St. John's Home when I was in the eighth grade, I intentionally, I don't think it was a wise decision, but failed all my subjects to be left back. And I was in the advanced classes. But as a result of being afraid of going from St. John's Home in Rockaway to downtown Brooklyn, St. Vincent's Home in downtown Brooklyn, I devised a system to fail all my subjects because I felt I was not ready to move on to the next institution in downtown Brooklyn.
And that really screwed up your path to getting out of the system, in that you were then limited in the future types of placements that the Catholic Church could offer you. Isn't that right?
Exactly, and that's what happened because education-wise, it was a bad decision because what happened was when they moved to St. Vincent's Home in downtown Brooklyn, when I selected my high school, John Jay High School in Brooklyn, I picked it for mainly because of it was co-ed. I was tired of living just with boys all my life. But consequently, what happened was I failed my subject. They didn't realize I had the intelligence, so they put me in what I call general courses. So you're right. So it was a setback. It was a setback educationally, too, for me. Going from advanced classes, they assumed I was dumb and stupid, because my marks reflected that, even though I intentionally did that. So you're right, it was a setback in my life. And it was tough because in those days, at 19 years of age or 18 years of age, when you graduated high school, you were discharged. And I was discharged at 18, 19 years of age and given a furnished room in Flatbush, Brooklyn, and given a job in the stockroom. And from there on, they shook my hand and said, good luck and the best of luck. And I was really petrified of the outside world. I didn't know what to do, where to go, where to turn to, et cetera.
Yeah, no, it was a very sad story of you being sent to that family in Long Island. And, you know, you were so used to being institutionalized, regulated, ordered. There were really no choices. This is what you did at this time of day. These
very
were the
good.
Type of clothes you wore. That was the school you went to. And now all of a sudden you had your freedom, and it was unnerving.
You're right on target. Right on target. I couldn't wait to get back. And they tried really hard. They were a good family. They tried so hard to make me get acclimated to the community and to the neighborhood and to the children and the neighbors. And I just felt so uncomfortable. In fact, Robin, now you can't shut me up. But for the first but until I was 30, I couldn't even talk. I couldn't even, when I went to Fordham University, I couldn't even, public speaking course, when it came my turn, I dropped out because I was afraid to stand in front of the class.
Ed, I've listened to a lot of your interviews. I know you've been on the Catholic Channel and some radio shows, and you're right. It's hard to shut you up. I agree with you.
Thank you, Robin.
Ed, contrast the orphanage system with the system today. There are no orphanages, are there?
There's no more. There's no more. They call it congregate care, but the most there are is maybe 24, 30, 50 kids in a setting. And here's the contrast today. The staff ratio back in those days was primarily religious, and it was 1 to 24, 1 to 72. Today, in group homes, the closest thing they have today, which they're pretty well at existence to, is 1 to 10. So there's a lot more attention. Today, there's a lot more resources today. What really did it, Robert, was the Lyndon Johnson, the great society, the administration, the anti-poverty programs in the mid-60s. Poured a lot of money into the system. And as a result of that, they really made a big turnaround as far as professionalizing these places and bringing the financial resources into the child care system. So today, there's a lot more resources than we ever had in my day. If kids take advantage of the opportunity, the resources are there today compared to my day. And yet there's no animosity. That's the way it was. The nuns and the priests did the best they could with what they had. So today there's a lot more resources, there's more individualized attention, there's more teaching, development, ADL, I call activities of daily living skills, there's money management, cooking. We didn't have any of those resources to teach me how to cook, money management, how to pay a bill, how to turn a light on, you know, the whole nine yards, because as you put out earlier, Robert, everything was done for me. Everything was done and sort of made me dependent on the system, on the institutions. And no making individual decision making, except for what I intentionally failed. But otherwise, decision making, as you said, everything was done for me. So
yeah,
I wasn't.
It's good that they had a system to care for you. It was bad that it was overcaring and didn't focus or aware of the fact that at some point you would need to be toward independent living skills. And that, I guess, that was the shortcoming. The strength was that yes, it cared for you 24/7. The shortcoming was that you were not prepared for any sort of independent living.
And part of it was because they didn't have the resources to do it. They didn't have the staff to do it. They didn't have one to 25 in a dormitory. It was almost like an impossible task to teach anybody. And that's why I felt bad for the brothers and the sisters and the lay people, because even though I know they probably wanted to do it, they couldn't do it. The numbers were just too – it was overwhelming. The odds were overwhelming for them.
Ed, you mentioned one of the things that also held you back during your period in the city in the church orphanages was the fact that your parents never signed off allowing you to be adopted. Were there any attempts to get them to come in to sign off, or were there any legal procedures implemented in order to free you up?
I'm not kidding you. You're asking an excellent question, because I'll tell you what. At the age of 13, this social worker in St. John's Home, a new young social worker, decided to do some diligent search, and she found my parents. In fact, for the first 13 years of my life, I thought I was a complete orphan. I didn't know I had anybody. I thought they died in an accident or an airplane, to be honest with you, until I was 13 years. And then the social worker, Elena Corella, St. John's Home, found my mother and father. By that time, she said they were married. It was 9 years later. They had twins. They got married. They lived in Queens. And she found them, and she got them to send me a birthday card. I think she put a lot of pressure on them to make my day. But I can tell, I guess I was a student at that age. I could tell when someone really cares for me or doesn't care for me. From the birthday card, I knew that they had no interest in finding me. Even though they sent me the birthday card, it was so impersonal that I knew. And then she admitted, I said to him, you sort of, she goes, yes, I put pressure on them. She goes, you're so astute for 13. I just, Ms. Corella, I can tell there's nothing behind this card. They want nothing to do with me. She goes, and she nodded. She goes, you're right. They want nothing. I said, well, why didn't they at least sign the papers? Why didn't they at least sign the parental papers to give someone else the opportunity to take me in? And then what also helped, Robert, was that before I had a psychological test done in one of the institutions. And because I did well, it's the standard BNA test, the standard psychological test that was given. And I did poorly with the blocks on that test at the age of 4 years old. And therefore, it was determined by the psychologist at that particular time that said that he can't live in a boarding home. He has to stay in the institution. So based on the test, I had to languish for another, 10, 15 years in institutions. So am I angry at the system? No. Was I angry? Yes, I was angry because I was confused, frightened, upset. But then I learned that I had to take responsibility and perseverance and determination. And you read my 10 beliefs, and that's in the heart. That if you follow those, if anybody follows my book, they can succeed, to be honest with you. There's no excuse.
No, it's a great read, Ed. And the other children that were in the orphanage with you, were they Ed Rose's too, or did everybody have their own individual story?
I think we're all the same. I think we're all in the same boat. We felt we were all in the same boat. It's amazing. The ones that started from birth, like I started from birth. But as it went on, from institution to institution, later years, some kids came in later in life. So they knew what it is to have a family. But most kids for the first 11, 15, 13 years had no families. And so I felt very fortunate when Aunt Catherine would, on every Christmas, Thanksgiving, and Easter, I would get a Christmas card or a Thanksgiving card and a birthday card. And then on my birthday, I would get a box of cookies, and most kids got nothing. I was very fortunate. And it was very fortunate. It was sad that on holidays, if it wasn't for the really top, great, the Rotary Club, the Elks Club, the Knights of Columbus, the fraternity of the police department, the fire department, these organizations came in, and they really made every effort on the holidays to make us have a good time, make a pleasant day, because the holidays were tough. The holidays were very, very tough because we had no place to go. But these organizations came in and really did a great job, and I realize now how important those organizations are.
Right. Yeah, your book has several mentions of fraternal groups, church groups,
yes.
coming in to, make your day a little brighter.
Yes. I mean, really, the Elks Club and the Knights of Columbus, you name the American Legion, you name these organizations, the Navy Yard, the Navy came in when we were kids. They really came in.
What was one of the most exciting
was coming in when I was in Covenant Mercy, when they came in for Christmas, and they came in and they bought tons and tons and tons of gifts and toys and presents. I remember sitting in the big playroom, and just an abundance of toys, wrapped toys coming in. It was overwhelming. It was exciting. The organization come in with the Christmas, especially Christmas. Christmas was the best time of the year for me in the younger places. When I got older, it stopped when I started becoming a teenager in St. John's Home. But what happened in place of parties, the organization would take us to the Yankee games, to the Mets games, to the Madison Square Garden, to the college games. So they made up for it in that way as I got older. But the best time was Well, the best time of my life was in St. John's Home, Robert. I learned how to tap dance. And we got so good that we were invited to the Brooklyn Academy of Music, downtown Brooklyn. Do you know, it was about 15 to 20 groups competing. We came in first place.
And yes, I read that in your...
So you were talking about, that was the most exciting accomplishment because it was my first time in my life. I worked hard on something, and I succeeded.
And then you were in demand to do other shows, right?
Yes, exactly. And then what happened was, it was really so good that when I got to St. Vincent's, we formed a group, a singing group, and yet we were in other shows, right? We were able to go to St. George Hotel and some other, the Grand Army Plaza, on 19th Street. There's a big catering hall there. We used to go there and perform for fundraisers and that kind of stuff.
Right, Prospect Hall now?
Prospect Hall, you got it. Prospect Hall, yes.
Ed, talk about, as you got older in the system, you had the opportunity to go out on Friday and Saturday nights, your book talks about, and, you know, go to dances or be with other people or games, but there was always that stigma that you were trying to hide of being in this orphanage. Talk about that for a second.
Yes, I always felt that, because we all dressed, we had the same shoes, the same pants, the same sneakers, the same juices. So I always was fighting for my individual identity. That was my biggest challenge in all the, especially in my adolescent years. It was tough. Going to John Jay High School, and the most of us, a lot of us went to John Jay High School, and the best scenario I can give you about the identity is I didn't want pity and shame and embarrassment. So I tried like heck to hide that we were from the institutions, and it was difficult because I thought it was written all over our faces. These are the St. Vincent's homeboys. For example, one story you'll get a kick out of this: in homeroom in John Jay High School, we had to give our addresses for attendance, and we all started giving addresses of Borum Place, State Street. We were trying to change the numbers.
Right. Yeah.
And the homeroom teacher goes, "Wait a minute, one second here. There's something going on in this class. There's too many State Street. There's too many Borum Places." But we were embarrassed. So I went up to him and I whispered to him. I went up to him. I had the nerve to go up to him and says, "We're from St. Vincent's Home." He was so understanding. Robert, he was so understanding, this homeroom teacher. He realized what we were going through, and he backed off completely. He realized that it had to be tough being raised in institutions, and we're trying to gain our independence, and we don't want to be identified with the other kids in the school that were from the institution. And the best story I can give you from the book was that when I first went to John Jay, that was the first public school I ever went to, and they registered me for the lunch program. Up until that time, and I didn't know I was on welfare. And so I'm on the line with my paperwork, and I've never been to a public school in my life. And I'm online with all the other students, boys and girls, getting lunch. I go into the entrance, and I didn't know I was supposed to put the food on my plate, on my tray. So I went through it. So it's a U. I went through. Everybody has food on their plates. I get to the cashier. She says, "Where is your food, Ed Rose?" I says, "I'm told to give you these papers." She takes them. She yells out, "Welfare, St. Vincent's, give him food." Well, for those 3 years, I never went back to the lunchroom. I never went back to lunch again. I was so humiliated. I never went back. I starved. I used to cash my tokens and get a butter roll for lunch for 2 years until I got over it.
Yes, an ignorant adult. Did you come across circumstances like this in other settings? I know you talked about sometimes going into stores and the storekeepers would also look upon you, with warily.
Yes, they always did, because in St. John's Home in Rockaway, we'd go to Rockaway Plain Road or 116th Street to all the stores, and the attendants would go up. The attendants would go up, here's the St. John's Home kids, here's the St. Vincent. We were always seen, quote, as bad kids. They didn't realize we were orphans. They just stereotyped and said, if you're in an institution, you must be a bad kid. You must be a bad kid. So they'd watch us like a hawk everywhere. I used to always feel the eyes watching me in the stores where we walked to, or make sure I don't steal anything and that kind of stuff. And years later, I realized now they all thought that was the institution were for kids that were bad, not because they didn't have any parents. And so there was a villain I always had to live with and be self-conscious of.
And were you able to make any friends with children outside of the orphanages, or was that a struggle?
That was a very big struggle. That was a struggle for many, many years. It was a struggle. The answer is no, I never really did. Except, I shouldn't say, at John Jay High School, I did make with one kid. He was an African-American kid, a real good kid that loved jazz. And we hung out one-on-one together for lunch. And that's the first outside friend I ever made. And he lived on Park Place and Flavish Avenue in Brooklyn. And I didn't tell him. Finally, it took a year for me to tell him. And he was shocked when I told him that I was from the... Because he kept saying, I don't see you going home to your parents. I guess it took him a long time to come up with that. He was afraid to ask me. And he finally says, Ed, I get the impression you don't have any parents, but you never talk about it. Because he always talked about his mother and father. And I always felt uncomfortable in school, in class, or in social gatherings when people talked about their parents. I was always petrified that they may come to me in a circle and say, what about your mother and father? So whenever they got to me, I always changed the subject. I always learned how to change the subject, Robert. I always changed the subject when it came to family.
Yeah, I'm sure you were always on the defensive when people started talking about their parents. And
always,
you probably
always
clammed up or tried to change the topic. Or
always
you
did.
Had stock answer.
Yes, always did. Always did. Always changed the subject. Always managed to change the subject when it came to family. When it came to talking about mother and father. Because I did not want people to know that I had no parents.
Yeah, a topic that comes up in every conversation, and you were not able to, it's like somebody who doesn't like sports getting in a group of people to talk about sports, and
that's why I felt.
You think about the Yankees, and you say I don't follow sports. I don't know this whole.
And that's why it's funny you said I followed NFL. I followed the Cleveland Browns. I did follow. We love sports. We love football. Because we did well in football in St. Vincent's home in Brooklyn, because that's all we had. We were very, very, very tough, and the book tells you about that. We were very, very, a very tough team. And I excelled in football because I was a strong kid. So that was one area that I really excelled, except for my vision. I had very poor vision, but it was one time I did excel. And what really helped me was working at Fordham University, working with the Division I student athletes. That was for 17 years. And Coach Tom Pendes, who was also an author of Dead Coach Walken, who coached at Fordham, Rhode Island, and Texas, kept begging me to tell the student athletes about my background because he knew. But he respected my wishes. I said, Tom, I don't want sympathy. I do not want people feeling sorry for me. He goes, they won't. You know what? 30 years later, he was right. It would help. It would have motivated the kids. This book motivates people. It gives them hope, and I was 100% wrong, Robert. I should have told, because when these same student-athletes who are grown men now with families who are very successful are all emailing me and telling me, Ed, I can't believe this. Since reading your story, my respect for you has doubled, tripled. We didn't know. And so Coach Pendes was correct, Robert. I should have told my story sooner. It gives people hope and inspiration. I made a mistake.
A lot of hope and inspiration. Ed, tell us about when you went into the orphanages, the type of children that were going in there were primarily from poverty families or children who had lost their parents in the war. But that's not the type of child that they're seeing today in the foster care system.
No, that's a very, very good point. The kids going in today, to be honest with you, I thought I had it tough. You know, parents not wanting me and abandoning me and just saying, giving me up because they didn't really want me. The kids coming in today are physically and psychologically abused. The abuse, and I learned this from being a social worker, going back, being a social worker, and reading these case records. And when I read these horror stories, to be honest with you, even though I had it tough, the abuse that these kids put up with, from their parents, it's 10 times tougher today. 10 times tougher today. What the kids coming to care? Because I was not abused. Other than those two incidents, you know, you read about in the book about that. And if you want me to bring it up, we can. But other than those isolated insulin. I call them aberrations. I was not. I felt safe and secure for 19 years, and because I was not physically abused overall and psychically abused. Kids come into care today for the last 20 years come in because they've really been abused physically and psychologically because of drugs, alcohol, substance abuse, violence, etc.
A whole different population.
Yes, a whole different population.
Of children was much more. Well, yours was serious, but theirs is physical, mental, emotional.
They're lucky they're alive. The abuse they really put up with, I'm telling you. I mean, the physical abuse, the beatings, and the scars are forever. I mean, these nuns, I was not abused by the sisters. I was not abused by the brothers. I really wasn't. Overall, I never got beatings, never none of that stuff. Never. Discipline, tough, stern, and structure, and discipline, control, yes. And they had to. With 140 boys, 170 kids, you have to have control and discipline.
Ed, you've gotten a lot of critical acclaim because of this book. Tell us a little bit about some of the reviews you've been hearing and what people have been telling you and how the book is being received.
It's overwhelming. I never expected this kind of response. And the biggest message I get from people is they can't get over that I have no anger, no animosity. That's the biggest review. So he has no animosity, no anger. He understands it was the circumstances, it was the times. And that's what people respect about the book. They also respect my resiliency, my motivation, my passion, and my determination, and perseverance. That's what they all tell me. That's the feedback I get. For example, now, I always thought the book was for young adults and above. Now I'm finding out more and more that they say it should be in every high school. I said, what? Ed, because kids don't appreciate their parents today. Your story, being raised without parents, would get kids to more appreciate their family. And sure enough, in Bay Ridge, I go to this Dolphin Gym in Bay Ridge, and this kid, a Pakistani kid who's going to go to the University of Binghamton now, I give him the book to read. He comes back at me, 18 years old, went to Adelphi Academy, smart kid, valedictorian, you name it. He said, reading your story, I don't think I could ever overcome the obstacles that you overcame, but yet your story has made me appreciate my parents more. I said, what? That's what it's done for me, and that's what everybody's telling me with the book, that it makes people appreciate what they have. That's a consistent review across the board. They say that's what
I have to say, after reading your book, Ed, you have a very positive take on your life, and you've turned it out positive. And we're going to end our show by letting me read one of the reviews that I see from a Father Paul Landolfi at St. John's Home for Boys. And he says, Ed Rowe's life journey takes him through the gamut of emotions, abandonment, confusion, loneliness, fear, discovery, appreciation, justice, and love. To his credit, he was determined not to let the circumstances of his life control his life, and he succeeded. Ed, you have written a wonderful book. You're a wonderful person. You're very strong and positive outlook on life. And we congratulate you and thank you for coming on our show to share your thoughts and insights with us.
And Robert, from the bottom of my heart, I really appreciate it. You've really been, this is very nice of you. Thank you very, very much. I appreciate it.
Ed, we love having you on.
Thank you. Right, bye-bye.
So this concludes tonight's radio program. Thanks to Blog Talk Radio for hosting our show. And thanks to our guest, Ed Rose, author of Raised by the Church, for being our guest, for sharing his insights with us. This is How's New York, signing off. God bless Brooklyn and all of its people. Wishing you a good night and a good morning and a good afternoon. I am your host, Robert Howe.
Try to keep the appearance.